compelling insights, unpredictable conversations, encouragement for your day. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
What's that line in the Santa Claus is Coming to Town? He knows when you've been sleeping. He knows when you're awake. He knows when you've been nice or good, so be good for goodness sake. Well, you could substitute the word Google for Santa. Man, Santa's got to be jealous of Google because Google knows everything about you. And what they don't know about you, they're aiming to know. This is from the UK Sun, an article about how if you have Google Home or Google Nest, and this is true of some of the other apparatuses that are similar to this, other brand names, Amazon and such, they are listening to you. Now, they're smart assistants, and they can do cool things, and you can get the weather and tell them to play the music or dim the lights. There are all kinds of neat things you can do with these, and I appreciate those neat things. I like the technology. I like the fact that I can arm or disarm the alarm system in my home if I'm on the other side of the planet with my phone. I can do that. Or turn on cameras. I mean, there are all kinds of things you can do. It's amazing. So I'm not against any of this, but I believe in privacy. And that's one of the things that you're trading away for the sake of some of these devices. So just here's what the Sun has to say. Consumers across the U.S. were sent into a panic back in 2019 when it was discovered that both Google and Amazon give human contractors access to audio clips from you. This would be like the Google Home and Amazon Echo devices. Dave Monsey's product manager for Google Search, he said back then, he says, as part of our work to develop speech technology for more languages, we partner with language experts around the world who understand the nuances and accents of a specific language. These language experts review and transcribe a small set of queries to help us better understand those languages. This is a critical part of the process of building speech technology and necessary to create products like Google Assistant, which is a way of saying, hey, we have a really good reason for recording what you say in the privacy of your own home and sending it to third-party people and let them analyze it and tell us, what did you really mean by what you said? We have a great, really good reason for spying on you.
All the money we're going to make.
Well, there's that. Do you think Google is into making money, Cyrus?
They're practically printing it at this point.
It's remarkable what they've done. I mean, in terms of the technological leaps. Say what you will. I mean, big tech, a lot of problems, that's for sure. But in so many ways, they have changed our lives for the better. So it's, if you ask me, it's a mixed bag. So Google has since changed its policies requiring Home or Nest users to opt out into having voice searches recorded in the first place. If you're unsure whether or not you're opted out on your device, or if you're just curious to know what Google has recorded you saying, there are ways to check. Even though Google changed its stance on recording voice searches, the rest of your Google ecosystem activity might still be getting, with no opt-in required, recordings of what's going on in your home. All of your Google activity can be found in the My Activity section of your Google account. Now, for the rest of this, if you want to know, first of all, how to see what Google has recorded, or if you want to take steps to delete it, you can do that. You can do the same thing with your phone. This shows you also how to turn off certain voice-activated features that could record what you're saying or doing. It's all in this article. It's kind of a step-by-step. So since all of us are in one way or another using Google, even if you're not using an Android phone, there are other ways in which Google is present in your life. The same is true, of course, of Facebook and other big tech companies. And if you feel, I don't really want them recording what's going on in my house, this article will give you the step-by-step on how you can erase it and how you can turn it off. 888-914-9149. Let's go to Betty now in Wilmington, North Carolina. Hi, Betty.
Hey, hi, is this Patrick?
It sure is.
Oh, I'm so happy to get through to you.
Thank
I you. Enjoy your show so much. You're so informative. I
Thank
always
you.
Enjoy listening to your show.
Thank
I'm
you.
A grandmother of a 19-year-old. I'm going to kind of cut through the chase. I'm a granddaughter of a 19-year-old. I'm so excited. And he is a country singer, mm-hmm. and he has a girlfriend who's attending a full scholarship college in Boone. Now, he wants to move to Boone, and my son and my daughter-in-law are so distraught over that. So we don't know how to handle this.
When you say he wants to move to Boone, I assume you mean he wants to move in with his girlfriend?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Right.
Well, here's the thing, Betty, and my heart goes out to you and to your son and daughter-in-law or daughter and son-in-law. There comes a time when, especially when they get to be 20 years of age and even older, where you can only express your concerns about it. Chances are that he was raised well. He knows right from wrong. His mom and dad made sure that he understood the gospel. And if at the age of 20 he's deciding that he's not going to live accordingly, there's really not much you can do. You can't force him. You can't stop him, obviously. And at least in my experience of having seen this play out countless times over the years, the more mom and dad ratchet up the pressure, the more difficult it becomes to reel that kid back in later.
Yeah.
And the temptation is at every moment, every time you see him, to tell him, stop doing this, stop doing this, stop doing this. And that's, of course, the right message. But usually there's, you know, the tendency on the part of parents to kind of overdo it. And it is counterintuitive, if you ask me. But I favor that sort of hang on loosely approach where you keep your communication open, you keep the relationship alive, you don't drive the son away or the daughter in hopes that you'll have an easier time of reasoning with them as they get older. And often, if they're raised right and they come from a good household, often, not always, but often, they do wind up straggling their way back, like the story of the prodigal son. So I'm not suggesting that you should just give up or not care, but maybe go about it in a way that's different from haranguing the young man, and that might make him dig his heels in more. You know what I mean?
Even if they want to move in together?
Well, that's what I assumed that you were talking about.
Okay, yes, okay. Yeah. Well, I know you would know the answer. I certainly appreciate your advice, and
you're very kind.
Certainly pass it on. You are too. You have a great, blessed day.
Okay? Thank you, Betty. I appreciate it very much. For what it's worth, everybody, and this is not a one-size-fits-all, it's not always going to be the right thing to do in any given case, but sometimes it is. If you're dealing with someone who's recalcitrant, and not necessarily, I don't know if this 20-year-old grandson is an example of that. Maybe not. But there may be a situation where somebody is hell-bent on going in a particular direction that you know is bad for them, and they know it too. They just don't want to admit it. Well, there's that little book called The Dogma of Hell. And if you want to see a copy of it, just go to relevantradio.com/Patrick and under links, click the link. I don't benefit from this in any way. I don't make any money on it. There's no benefit to me at all. But the reason I mention it is because in the past, I have given this book to people I care about and have said, you know what? You know, Jesus said that if you do these things and death catches you unprepared and you don't repent, you're going to go to hell. So you might as well find out what it's going to be like. And this little book here will tell you all about where you're going. Because if you're going there, you might as well know something about what it will be like when you arrive. And amazingly, even though that sounds flippant and glib, it's really not. I mean, it's really true. And I've seen it happen where people have had turnarounds, they've had conversions because they've read this little book about hell. Basically, it's saying what Jesus said in the Bible and a few other details as revealed by God over time. And not only have I seen this, but we heard, in fact, within the last year or so, I'll never forget, this young woman called the program. And she said, Patrick, you know, I'm fairly recent to listening to your program, and I want to thank my brother because he's the one that suggested I do so. And she started crying, and she said, you know, I'm young, and I've been living a wild lifestyle. I've been living a very immoral, wild lifestyle. She didn't get into it. I don't think she needed to. And she said, I was raised Catholic, and then I got out of high school, and I just started living the party life. And my brother, who's concerned about me, he kept bugging me. He said, you should listen to this program. You should listen to this program. Listen to this program. She said she would never do it. And then one day, for some reason, she's like, okay, I'll do it. She started listening to the program. And she said, what happened? She's listening, and all of a sudden, she hears me mention this book about hell. I mean, what are the odds, right? How likely is that coincidence? So she just happens to hear me out of the blue, talking about this book on hell. So she said it kind of touched her. It touched her soul. So she ordered the book. The book shows up the following day from Amazon. She might be listening right now. If you're listening right now, call me. And you can say this in your own words, ma'am. She said she ordered the book. Next day it shows up from Amazon. She reads the book. She has a complete turnaround, a complete reconversion experience. Top to bottom, she goes back to the sacrament. She goes to confession. She stops all the stuff that was going on. And then she calls me up in tears to express her gratitude to Relevant Radio. Because had it not been for that series of events, who knows what she'd be up to right now. So when I suggest this book, I'm telling you, there is a track record here. And try it. What have you got to lose, right? Parents, grandparents, people who care about people that you care about, what have you got to lose? If you've tried everything and nothing works and you're not getting through and they won't listen, what have you got to lose, right? And again, no benefit to me in any way whatsoever when you use this book to try to help somebody. But you'll find it by going to relevantradio.com/Patrick. Click on links and then click on the one that says the book on hell. We'll go now to Joseph in Chicago. Good morning, Joseph.
Patrick, concerning St. Joseph, there doesn't seem to be any archaeological existence of him as far as like we don't know where he was buried. There's no relics of him at all, you know, like there is of the Blessed Mother or other saints. Mm-hmm. Why is that? Any idea?
Yes. First of all, there are no relics of the Blessed Virgin Mary because at the point of her death or shortly thereafter, she was assumed bodily into heaven. So there are no mortal remains of the Blessed Mother. As for St. Joseph, I think the safe answer is simply that he was a humble man. He was given this very august job, this duty by God himself to safeguard the Christ child and to safeguard the Blessed Virgin Mary. He's not recorded as having said anything in Scripture. It's referred to that he said that Jesus' name was Jesus, but there's nothing recorded of him speaking like we see from the other major figures. We know that in addition to the Blessed Virgin Mary, he would have been the closest person to Jesus for all the years that Jesus lived at home with them. So my thinking is that it was his humility and the fact that he served his role wonderfully. He fulfilled it admirably. And then in God's time, he passed on. And we're not meant to know anything more than that. Now, the fact that there are no inscriptions or, as you mentioned, archaeological evidences for St. Joseph, that shouldn't trouble you. That doesn't in any way call into question his existence. I think it just means that God did not deign for us to know more about St. Joseph in this life, at least.
Okay. Sounds good. Thank you. Okay.
You're welcome. St. Joseph, pray for us. We'll go now to Leslie in Newbury, Ohio. Good morning, Leslie. Where is Newbury? What part of the state is that in?
Newbury's like about 30 minutes east of Cleveland, near like Chagrin Falls, Bainbridge, Ohio.
Yeah, Chardon, Cuyahoga Nobel, territory, right?
We're in Geauga County, so we're in the country.
Oh, gotcha. Okay, well, welcome.
So I just wanted to share something I had actually learned when I went to a Life Team conference. Mm-hmm. And this young couple, and I can't remember who it was, talked about living together and premarital sex. And so the gentleman speaker said, you know, say to your kids, so do you love this person? Yes, I love them. So you mm-hmm. love them enough to have sex? Yeah. So you're living together. Do you love them enough to live together? Well, yes, mm-hmm. that's why we're moving in together, because we love each other. So he said, and then the next comment should be, so you don't love them enough to make a commitment to them and honor them by not having sex and doing these things ahead of time. I mean, we're sitting in this conference center with 15,000 teens. They got so quiet.
Right.
You could hear a pin drop. But I used that with our son, and he didn't know how to counter it.
I bet.
So I just thought that was a very valuable tool I used with all three of my sons, and it really does work.
How old were they when you used this rhetorical device with them?
22, so he was just out of college. 22, the other two, in probably the same time frame, mm-hmm. like between 20, probably 24.
And did it work?
Boys. Two out of the three.
Mm-hmm. That's good. That's 63%. That's good. 66%. That's good.
So I'll take it. But I just thought it was really great thing that we learned down in Steubenville at that conference.
I like it. That's good advice for everybody, Leslie. Thank you.
Awesome. All right. Yeah. Thanks so much.
Thank you, and thanks for listening. Hey, I want to share with you something. We will do some more phone calls here in a minute. This is against the backdrop of some of our discussions that we've been having about things like critical race theory nonsense and some of the gender ideology nonsense and other ideologies that are just very militantly being rammed down people's throats. And of all people to respond to this, a columnist and author by the name of Andrew Sullivan weighed in the last few days. And I read his article and then I reread it. And I want to share some of this with you. It came out at his Substack. It's at andrewsullivan.substack.com. First, a little bit about him. I think he might be a little bit younger than me. He's avowedly gay. He's very much out there pro-homosexual. I believe that he is still married, quote unquote, to a man that he's married to. He's all about gay rights, pro-abortion. He's a leftist. He's a liberal. I'm trying to think of the right word to use because now the meaning of these words is changing. And his thesis in this article, which I encourage you to read, you know, he voted for President Obama. He loves that stuff. That's his world. He is a dyed-in-the-world liberal. And even he is looking around and scratching his head and saying, and this is the title of his article, what happened to you? The radicalization of American liberals. So even he is now saying, wait a minute, guys, you are going way too far. You're not even really liberal anymore. You're something extreme. And he points out how most of the left, most all of the Democratic Party, most of the people that he would otherwise feel very comfortable with ideologically have gone berserk. So when we return from this break, it's going to be a quick break, but don't go away because you want to hear this. I'm going to share with you some of the highlights of this very well-written article from a guy who, with whom I would disagree on probably 80% of everything, but he's right on target in this, and it's causing quite a stir because he is standing up and saying, you guys are whack. I mean, you guys have gone way too far. This is a problem, and they don't know how to handle it. Because he, at least until fairly recently, was one of them. And wait till you hear how he critiques. This is a dyed-in-the-wool liberal, pretty far left. Wait till you hear how he critiques critical race theory, etc. You don't want to miss this. I'll be right back with that right after this. Notre Dame Federal Credit Union is a member of the Catholic Credit Unions of America. You can find more information and your local Catholic Credit Union at relevantradio.com/banking.
Keeping it relevant. It's the Patrick Madrid Show. Get connected to the conversation. Call now. 888-914-9149. That's 888-914-9149. Patrick Madrid is on now. Relevant Radio.
I mentioned Andrew Sullivan. He's a man of the left, gay, married to another man. You can check off all the boxes that you would typically expect for somebody who is left of center, maybe even far left of center. Okay. That's where he's coming from. And he's a prominent writer, he's well known, and he's a very good writer. I disagree with much of his worldview, and I'm sure he would disagree with much of my worldview, but I have to admit he's a very good writer. He's a very effective, incisive writer. And I think he hit it out of the park with an article that just appeared in the last few days. It's called What Happened to You? The Radicalization of the American Elite Against Liberalism. Now, I'm going to offer you just a few selections from this article, but Cyrus, have you had a chance to post that yet on the show Twitter feed?
It's just there right now.
Okay. Okay, great. So thanks. So this is there's a link there if you want to read the whole article. I encourage you to do so. And if you are as conservative can be, still read this article. He's going to talk in places about how he's all about Barack Obama and how he voted for Barack Obama. Okay, fine. If you didn't like Barack Obama, so much the better. Because here's a guy who has a very different worldview, chances are, from yours, but yet he's making a very good point because he sees a problem that exists on the left that many people on the left don't see. And I'm not sure if they know quite what to do with him because they can't fault him for his worldview. They can't say that they disagree with him for his worldview. And yet he's pointing out the extremes to which they're going and how I think ultimately I'm adding this to what he had to say. I don't think he himself said this, but I believe that the trajectory will lead ultimately to a kind of destruction of the ability of people who are going too far to be in any way effective in promoting what they believe. But anyway, we'll get to that. So here is, these are some selections from his article again called What Happened to You. He says the CRT debate, and this is critical race theory, is just the latest squall in a tempest brewing and building for 5 years or so. And yes, some of the liberal critiques of a Fox News hyped campaign are well taken. Is this a wedge issue for the GOP? Of course it is. Are they using the term critical race theory as a cynical marketing boogeyman? Of course they are. Are some dog whistles involved? A few. Are crude bans on public servant speech dangerous? Absolutely. Do many of the alarmists know who Derek Bell was? Of course not. I'll pause there. Derek Bell, if you listen to this program, you know who Derek Bell was because I've shared this information with you several times over the weeks. He was that Harvard law professor, the black law professor, who pioneered this way of looking at American law and jurisprudence through the lens of race. This is where the idea of critical race theory emerges, from his scholarship and his looking at these things through a critical lens. So if you've been listening to the program, of course you know who Derek Bell was. Maybe many other people don't, but you do. He says, but does this mean there isn't a real issue here? Of course it doesn't. Now, I'm just going to share with you some selections from this article. I can't read you the whole thing because it's too long, but it's worth reading, okay? Take a big step back. Observe what has happened in our discourse since around 2015. Forget critical race theory for a moment and ask yourself, is nothing going on here but Republican propaganda and guile? Can you not see that the Republicans may be acting, but they are also reacting against something that is right in front of our noses? What is it? It is, I'd argue, the sudden, rapid, stunning shift in the belief system of the American elites. It has sent the whole society into a profound cultural dislocation. It is, in essence, an ongoing moral panic against the specter of quote-unquote white supremacy, and these are his quote marks, which is now bizarrely regarded as an accurate description of the largest, freest, most successful multiracial democracy in human history. I'm going to pause there and add my own little comment. It is all of those things that's true. It's also the country that two times in a row elected a black man as president, President Barack Obama. We all know it's happened, he says. The elites increasingly sequestered within one political party and one media monoculture, educated by colleges and private schools that have become hermetically sealed against any non-left dissent, have had a social justice reckoning these past few years. And they have been ideologically transformed with countless cascading consequences. Now, he talks about critical race theory. He says it's a decent approximation for this new orthodoxy. And that is precisely this exasperation with liberalism's seeming inability to end racial inequality in a generation that prompted Derek Bell et al. To come up with the term in the first place. He says a specter of invisible and unfalsifiable systems and structures and internal biases, and those are all in quote marks, arrive to hover over the world. Some of this critique was specific and helpful, the legacy of redlining, the depth of the wealth gap, but much was tendentious postmodern theorizing. The popular breakthrough was Ta-Nehisi Coates' essay on the reparations in the Atlantic and his subsequent gut-wrenching memoir, Between the World and Me. He says he combined the worldview and vocabulary of critical race theory with the vivid lived experience in his own biography. He's a beautifully gifted writer, and I am not surprised that he had such an emotional impact, even if, in my view, this is Andrew Sullivan's view, the power of his prose blinded many to the radical implications of the ideology he surrendered to in what many of his blog readers called his blue period. He says, the movement is much broader than race, as anyone who is dealing with matters of sex and gender will tell you. The best moniker I've read to describe this mishmash of postmodern thought and therapy culture ascendant among white liberal elites is Wesley Yang's coinage, the successor ideology. The structural oppression, quote unquote, is white supremacy. But that can also be expressed more broadly among Crenshaw lines to describe a hegemony that is saturated with anti-blackness, misogyny, and transphobia in a miasma of social cis-heteronormative patriarchal white supremacy, which is just, it's just code for the fact that there are men and women, and yes, men have generally taken the lead when it comes to things like government and armies and various other things. He says, in the successor ideology, there is no escape, no refuge from the ongoing nightmare of oppression and violence. And you are either fighting this and on the right side of history, quote unquote, or you are against it and abetting evil. There is no neutrality, no space for skepticism, no room for debate, no space even for staying silent. Silence, remember, is violence, perhaps the most profoundly anti-liberal slogan ever invented. And I'm reading to you I think a fascinating and very trenchant, very insightful article from Andrew Sullivan. It's available at his website. And we posted a link on the show Twitter feed at P Madrid Show, so you can read it in its entirety. I'm just sharing selections of it with you. He says, and that will tell you, and that tells you about the will to power behind this slogan, silence is violence. Liberalism leaves you alone. The successor ideology will never let go of you. Liberalism is only concerned with your actions. The successor ideology is concerned with your mind, your psyche, and the deepest recesses of your soul. Liberalism will let you do your job and let you keep your politics private. The successor ideology will force you into a struggle session as a condition for employment. What happened to me? You know what I want to know, he says. What on earth has happened to you? Now, he's saying this to his fellow liberals, so many of whom have become so radicalized and so antagonized. I'm going to just skip over, and there's so much here that I wish I could read all of it to you, but I want to get to the next section here. He says, to say this today would evoke instant accusations of being a white supremacist and a racist. That's how far the left has moved. Now, he's referring here, he says, about taking, he says, what about people who say you have to take responsibility for your own life? By demanding more from our fathers and spending more time with our children and reading to them and teaching them that while they may face challenges and discrimination in their own lives, they must never succumb to despair or cynicism. They must always believe that they can write their own destiny. So he's responding to that way of thinking, saying, for today's liberal elites, to say this would evoke instant accusations of being a white supremacist and a racist. That's how far the left has moved. Obama as an enabler of white supremacy. You keep asking, what happened to me? He says, I remain an Obamacon, same as I've always been. Obamacon. What in contrast has happened to you? He's speaking to his fellow liberals. Check out this really insightful interview of Wes Yang by Matt Taibbi. Yang beautifully explains the radical shift in elite opinion. He notes the ascending rhetoric. Here's a quote. So there is a line in a N plus one essay where the person is saying, oh, we are now menaced by whiteness and masculinity. Whereas in the past, we would have said we are menaced by racism and sexism. He sees what this movement is about. The end of due process, the rejection of even an attempt at objectivity, a belief in active race and sex discrimination or equity, quote unquote, to counter the legacy of the past. The purging of ideological diversity and the replacement of liberal education with left indoctrination. Now, here's the money quote, and I'll leave it at this, but I want you to listen to this and then read the rest of the article. Here's the money quote. Look how far the left's war on liberalism has gone. Due process, if you're a male on campus, gone. Privacy, stripped away by anonymous rape accusations, exposure of private emails, violence against people's private homes, screaming at folks in restaurants, sordid exposés of sexual encounters eagerly published by woke magazines. Nonviolence? Exceptions are available if you want to punch a fascist. Free speech? Only if you don't mind being fired and ostracized as a righteous consequence. Free association? You've got to be kidding. Religious freedom? Illegitimate bigotry. Equality? Only group equity counts now, and individuals of the wrong identity can and must be discriminated against. Colorblindness, another word for racism. Mercy, not for oppressors. Intent, irrelevant. Objectivity, a racist lie. Science, a manifestation of white supremacy. Biological sex, replaced by socially constructed gender so that women have penises and men have periods. The rule of law, not for migrants or looters. Borders, racist. Viewpoint diversity, a form of violence against the oppressed. I mean, talk about hitting the bullseye. So there it is. And I don't think there's anything more I really need to say about it, but it is worth your time and energy to read the article and maybe share it with some of your liberal friends. If you have liberal friends, or if you're a liberal and you have conservative friends, you could say, hey, look, here's a guy on the left who understands it. He gets it. And I admire the fact that he's willing to stand up and pull no punches, and it's kind of amazing and funny to me at the same time to watch how some people are reacting to this, because they don't know how to deal with that, other than just try to shut him down and say, you know, you're a traitor. What happened to you? 888-914-9149. Let's go to Alicia listening in Winfield Park, New Jersey. Hi, Alicia.
Hi, Patrick. Thank you for taking my call. And I thank God that he has blessed us with your gifts and your intelligence. I wish that I could invite you for dinner to sit with my intellectually smart daughter who has turned away from God, from the church. She believes that Jesus is an ascended spirit. She has crystals. She's going to a medium to channel the dead. She has spirit guides and spirits and Reiki and all kinds of things. Mm. She's even teaching her unbaptized daughter about potions, and they have fairy gardens. And, you know,
how old is the daughter?
I don't.
Not your daughter, but her daughter.
My only child. Her daughter is going to be 5 years old in September, and then she has a little boy, too. Now, I baptize these children with holy water in my home just to, I know it's not valid, but I just needed
it's valid.
God to protect them.
It's valid. Let's pause there.
You know, let me pause there. Anything.
Let me pause there, Alicia. If you baptize with water, and you say the words out loud as you're baptizing, pouring the water over the head of the person or immersing them, I baptize you in the name of the Father and of the Son and of the Holy Spirit, and you intend to baptize, in other words, you're not acting a role in a movie or something like that, then it is a valid baptism. It is absolutely valid.
Oh, thank God.
Now,
thank God.
You'll want to take a few steps to make sure that those baptisms are recorded in the local parish, but that's a separate topic. I just want you to know that that is valid if you did those things.
Thank God. I told my daughter that I am truly worried. I told her, you know, she was brought up Catholic, went to Catholic college, all Catholic schools. And I told her, I said, Leanne, you are responsible spiritually to raise your children. You have to give them, you know, a faith. And she said, well, I don't understand what the Catholic faith did for me. I said, the Catholic faith is why you're spiritual now, why you know that there's good and evil in the world. Mm-hmm. But she has chosen to go to this left. She's an extreme left wing. She had, you know, a lesbian, transgender relationship.
Did she go to public school?
No, she went to Catholic school. She went to, I'm not naming the schools, but a really Catholic university, too. And that's where she hooked up with, you know, kids that were trying to find themselves, and they got involved in alcohol. And
yeah,
then she went into this downward spiral. You know, but she's in recovery now, but she's living with the father of the children. They're not married. She doesn't believe in marriage. You know, I just, for me, as a parent, my heart, it breaks for the salvation. I'm always praying for the salvation of their soul. That's all I pray for the, you know, my family tree. Now, what I can do is offer the love of Jesus to these children. And, you know, maybe as a prodigal, like you were saying, the prodigal son, God, you know, I trust Jesus, and I may never see the conversion, you know, because I'm older and I may not be in this life, you know, I don't know when, but I may never see that conversion, but I do trust because I know how Jesus converted my life. So,
yeah, that's a good point. Let's start there. And I have a break coming, so forgive me for being somewhat abbreviated here. I'm glad you pointed that out. You saw what Jesus did for you. You saw how God had patience with you. Now, I don't need to know what you went through, but we all go through some stuff, some people more than others. We all go through some things. And so the fact that God was patient with you is a great reminder to you. And you don't even need me to tell you this because it sounds like you already know this, to have a similar kind of patience with your daughter, which doesn't mean that you approve of what she's doing. It will still cause you heartache. You'll still be worried. I understand all those emotions. And believe me, I can completely relate to you. But as you know, Alicia, God loves her even more than you do. And God will continue to pursue her. It's good that you are speaking out to her. I hope that she will at least continue to listen to you and to come visit you and have a relationship with you. The strongest weapon in your arsenal right now is going to be your prayers, and in particular, praying the rosary. I would just rely upon Our Lady as your heavy artillery by praying the rosary for your daughter every day, which chances are you're already doing. So just as an encouragement, keep doing that. And invoke Our Lady's intercession to help your daughter in ways that you would be unable to do because she won't hear it from you. Lastly, I'll recommend a book. It's called Yoga, Tai Chi, Reiki, A Guide for Christians by Brother Max Scully. And this is a very helpful book. It takes each of these three things and looks at them and offers a critique. It's a gentle critique. It's not hard-hitting or angry or anything like that. But it's very detailed in explaining the specifics of some of the things you're talking about that your daughter's involved in. And for you to understand what those things are, I think would be a big help in trying to reason with her and talk to her. And fundamentally, most importantly, to talk to her and keep talking to her about Jesus. Jesus has come to set us free from all these things that would otherwise enslave us. Jesus has come to tell us the truth. You will know the truth, he said, and the truth will set you free. So the more that you can continue gently as best you can to talk to her about Jesus and how Jesus wants her to be happy, and those things do not lead to happiness, I think you will have success in due time, and Our Lady will help you. Hang in there, Alicia, and thank you so much for calling today. I really appreciate it. I'll be back with more right after this. Catholic Order of Foresters is proud to sponsor the Relevant Radio Studio Line. For information about employment opportunities and flexible premium life insurance plans, visit relevantradio.com/forester.
Welcome back to the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio. Have a question? Give Patrick a call. 888-914-9149. That's 888-914-9149. This is the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio and RelevantRadio.com.
With 14 minutes left, we will go to Claire. I was coming straight to you, and I don't know what happened. We had Claire first. We had Claire ready, didn't we? Claire, jump ship. Okay, Claire, call back. Let's go to the Bronx and talk to LeFleur. Good morning, LeFleur.
Yes, good morning. Hi there. I've been hearing you talk about the Fridays, mm-hmm. about abstaining from meat. And from what I know is that when the feast day falls on a Friday, we can mm-hmm. eat meat.
That's true.
And during the Fridays of Easter. What do you say about that?
I say what the church says, and that's you can. You're dispensed from that. Discipline when it comes to I believe it's a first class feast day or a solemnity that falls on a Friday. That's correct.
Mm-hmm. I've just never heard you make that distinction before whenever this topic came up. That's why I called.
Yeah, no problem. I think in the past when there's been actually on the calendar something like that, I've mentioned it, but it's not something I mentioned today, if that's what you're referring to, which is why I'm glad you raised it.
And the last time it came up also, that's when I first wanted to call about it, but I was lazy about calling.
Okay. Well, did we get it done?
Yes, we did. Thank you very much.
Thank you. I appreciate that. Let's go now to Kevin. Where is Kevin? Traverse City. Hello, Kevin.
Oh, I'm on Hey, how you doing? Just listening to the show, getting real riled up. But I think you earlier asked somebody to, you were having a discussion about pedophilia and homosexuality, and you asked them to, like, you're being very specific about, like, using evidence to assert your opinion. But what I'm wondering if you can do, because you just read that article by Andrew Sullivan, is if you can say, like, here's a location where we're losing the presumption of innocence in America. I mean, you say, like, college campuses, but I guess I would say, like, what college campus? Because there seems to be a push for just more investigation. Like, what's wrong with collecting more evidence on this case that is happening?
Okay, I want to make sure I'm following your question. And help me out here. When you say, because you're reacting, I guess, to what Andrew Sullivan said, when he said presumption of innocence, not if you're a white male. I'll have to go back and reread that section. But is that what you're referring to?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So I'll repeat what he says. I'll repeat what he says just to make sure everybody's on the same page. He says, due process, if you're a male on campus, gone. Privacy, stripped away, et cetera, et cetera. So let's take as an example, if that's what you're looking for, the lacrosse players who were at, I'm going to have to look this up to get the
Duke.
Yeah, the Duke University lacrosse players. And they were essentially hounded off of campus. They were indicted in the court of public opinion. They had been falsely accused, as it turns out, by the woman who raised these objections, or not objections, these accusations against them. And there would be an example, one of many, I would say, where you've got these men who were judged and convicted in the court of public opinion when it turns out in aftermath they had done nothing wrong.
And what happened after that?
Well, I'm not here to give an exhaustive account of it, but my point is you asked for an example and there's an example. These things do happen. And I don't think that Andrew Sullivan, I don't know him and I'm not here to defend him, but I think he's absolutely on target when he explains that as a general course of procedure in academia as such, academia, this is the kind of thing that we see routinely. So I don't have to catalog these for you. You can do that. Just do a little Google searching, Kevin, and you'll find it. But he's making a good point that these things do happen on a regular basis.
Happen. These things don't happen.
They do happen.
You're taking you're taking one specific example and applying it to like the broad stroke of America and saying we're losing all these rights.
Not true. And the fact that you're asserting that doesn't mean that it's right. The fact that you're claiming it doesn't happen doesn't mean it's not happening. So all I can do is say Google is your friend, Kevin. If you want to look it up, the evidence is there. And I think that'll help clarify the issue for you. Let's see, 888-914-9149. That's the number to dial if you want to be on the program. We still have a little bit of time. I'm hoping that Claire will call back in. And Claire, I don't know if Claire is listening right now. But that would be a call that I would be interested in taking. You know, I just want to mention briefly the book that I referred to a second ago. It's called Yoga, Tai Chi, Reiki, A Guide for All Christians. And I really haven't mentioned that book often on this program, but I thought I would give you a little bit more information on it. It gets into, in the issue of yoga, which is the first part of the book, it talks about the origins in Hinduism, what's the philosophy behind yoga. But then it goes into how yoga is often, especially in a religious setting, how it is sort of syncretized with Catholic teaching. And I remember as I was reading this book, I remember vividly one time when my wife and I, when we were newly married, I don't remember, if maybe we had one or two children at the most, but we were invited to go to a Catholic parish near us where they were doing a prayer workshop. So we got there and there's, 40, 50 people there, most all of whom were older. In fact, most of the people who were there were retirement age. And so Nancy and I were there and we thought, oh, we're going to learn how to do, meditation. And we did, but it wasn't Catholic meditation. It wasn't Christian. They kept talking about these chakras and these chakras that are in your spinal column, energy centers, they referred to them. And I remember asking the nun who was doing this presentation, I said, what? Because she was saying, imagine a serpent coiled up inside of you at the base of your spine. And imagine that as you reach these different levels of consciousness in your prayer, in your meditation, that the serpent is uncoiling and rising up to the top of your head where the seventh chakra is. The first chakra would be down at the very base of your spine. And then as it moves progressively up, these energy centers are located all the way up to the very top of your head. And I remember saying, that seems kind of weird to me that you're saying that there is a serpent, so to speak, that's coiled up inside you. I said, that imagery does not really work for me very well. And she gave me some sort of, you know, mishmash of, you know, well, it's not really a snake and all that kind of thing. But when I was reading this book many, many years later, I saw, oh, now I get it even more clearly. I get what it was that they were trying to say. And it, in fact, is a spirit, a serpent that they describe that's coiled up and as it comes up. So in this book, it was interesting for me to kind of see some of the things that I had wondered about or thought about or had looked at before but didn't have as much information on as this book provides. So if you or somebody you know is involved in this, this at the very least would be something good for you to be aware of so that you've got some more details to bring to bear in a conversation. Then he gets into Tai Chi. And Tai Chi, in the beginning of this article, at the beginning of this chapter, it says the Tai Chi is very popular. It's even a big business and is seen in the health profession as a means to good health, physical and emotional. Even the martial art form, which is not really what it's referring to here. It's referring here more to the relaxation exercises and breathing exercises and things. It says, even this is regarded as the gentlest of the martial arts, lacking the aggression which some find disconcerting. To consider Tai Chi in any way harmful is generally regarded as erroneous and alarmist. And I'm glad he takes this approach to these questions because he takes into account the fact that there are people for whom this seems very misplaced. Like, why are you criticizing this stuff? There's really nothing wrong with it. So he gets into lots and lots of the details of this that would escape most people's view. And here again, I think it's very helpful. Then the last part of the book is dealing with Reiki. Reiki is something having to do with healing and energy. He talks about how across the world there are more than 200,000 self-proclaimed Reiki masters, primarily in Western countries. He talks about the leading proponents and the claims that they make and the forecasts that they make about Reiki becoming a predominant force in healing, using the energy in the body, relaxation, how to fall asleep, etc. And all those things, I'm sure in their proper context, sound good. But he gets into how there is a backside to all of this that is problematic and even dangerous. So the name of the book, again, it's called Yoga, Tai Chi, Reiki, A Guide for Christians. And I offer this to you primarily for the sake of information. It's very well researched and very carefully footnoted. And if you're even just curious about what is going on with some of these things, not necessarily that you're going to take a stand one way or the other, but you're just interested in more detail, I would recommend that. 888. Yeah, I don't know if I should give the number out because we're getting down to the last few minutes. 888-914-9149 is the number to call. We might have a chance to get you on the air. Let's go to Valerie in Oregon. Welcome to the program, Valerie.
Hi, Patrick. Thanks for taking my call. Quickly, sure. We moved from a conservative community about a year ago to a relatively conservative community in Southern Oregon. And we have been married 30 years, very traditional. We have neighbors literally right across from us mm-hmm. who are a younger married couple, probably in their 40s, who are swingers. And mm-hmm. My husband became friends before we knew they were swingers. And we're not sure how to be Christian neighbors with a couple that we know partakes in what we consider right. an abomination, basically. But at the same time, if we aren't present in our neighborly Christian form, how can we witness? We have done some things like put a cross on top of our roof that overlooks their yard because they have parties, quote unquote, in their backyard.
COVID has they love that. We have about a minute left, Valerie. Are you looking for a little advice?
Yeah, like do we socialize with them or not?
I wouldn't socialize with them. One passage that comes to my mind is 1 Corinthians 15:33. Do not be deceived. Bad company ruins good morals. So that's different. You know, hanging out on the back patio and having cocktails with them is not something I would do for the reasons you just mentioned. But if it were a matter of having conversations with them, smiling and waving and talking maybe out in the front yard or something, sure, I would do that. I would look for opportunities to be friendly to them, to show them the love of Jesus. And if it got to the point where I could give them some good advice and help warn them away from this, I would do so. You can't really do that if you don't have any relationship with them. But on the other hand, I would not go on vacations with them, or I wouldn't, you know, I wouldn't go in that direction. I hope that helps. What an odd situation, Valerie, but God has you there for a reason. So you and your husband can be a light shining in that dark place for them. And I hope that it will result in some conversion. Thank you. I'll be back again with you tomorrow. Until then, I'll pray for you. Please pray for me. God bless you.